This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The presidential race appears to be very close, and it's conceivable that the next president will have won the vote in the Electoral College without having won the popular vote. And this possibility has many people wondering if it's time to abolish the Electoral College system. My guest, Akhil Amar, says we should abolish it. Amar teaches constitutional law at Yale Law School. My other guest, Curtis Gans, says keep the Electoral College, but reform it. Gans is the founding director of the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. The Electoral College was written into the Constitution in 1787. When you vote for president, you're actually voting for the elector pledged to that candidate. Each state has the same number of electors as its combined number of U.S. senators and representatives. There are 100 senators and 435 representatives in Congress, and the District of Columbia has 3 electors in the college, bringing the total to 538. With the exception of Maine and Nebraska, in each state, the presidential candidate who has won the majority of votes wins the state's total number of electoral votes. This winner-take-all approach is what makes the battleground states so important. I asked Gans and Amar how they think the Electoral College system has affected the campaign. Here's Gans.
This election illustrates both the strengths and the weaknesses of the Electoral College. The weaknesses are obvious. We may have an election in which we have a winner in a popular vote and a different winner in the Electoral College vote. The second weakness is also obvious, which is all the resources, or almost all the resources, of this campaign are being concentrated on about 17 states, with each candidate giving up the other states as winner, some of them for the opposition and some of them for himself. The strengths are also illustrated in this election, which is to say, in those battleground states, the competition is really fierce. The candidates have to speak to the disparate groups in those states, have to take into account their views, have to build winning coalitions, have to organize on the grassroots amongst these various and disparate groups to maximize their vote. And in those states, you have democracy and pluralism working as it should. But we do have 33 states in the District of Columbia that have essentially been abandoned by these campaigns.
Akhil Amar, do you agree with that?
Yeah, it's a pretty strong indictment of the system when basically two-thirds of the states are taken for granted, and voters in those states might not feel a particularly strong imperative to go out to vote. The governments in those states might not have a particularly strong incentive to encourage their voters to turn out. If you had direct popular election, the system that I favor, which is basically how we pick governors across the country. It's not an odd system at all. It's how we pick senators across the country within each state. If you had a system of direct national popular election, every state government actually would have a strong incentive to get its citizenry out to vote. The more folks, let's say, from Massachusetts go out and vote, then the more Massachusetts is counting in a larger national election. And what's true for Massachusetts is true for New York and California and Arkansas and every other state. And so you'd have, I think, better incentives for our governments to make it easier for us to vote and to get us out to vote.
Well, before we get deeper into the debate about the Electoral College, another question about how the electoral vote is affecting this year's campaign. Let's look at the Ralph Nader campaign. Do you think that a third-party campaign like that has any more or less of an effect with the Electoral College? For example, say that there's a swing state, and the say Nader gets 5%, and that siphon votes from Al Gore in that state, and therefore the state gives all of its electoral votes to George Bush. Would that mean that Nader's having a disproportionate effect in the electoral system than he would in the popular vote?
I think that the biggest difference for third-party candidates is the following. If you have direct popular election, if you amend the Constitution, you're going to have to try to think about the following question. Is it going to be enough for someone to get a plurality of the national popular vote, or do they need an absolute majority? If they need an absolute majority, you're going to basically have to ask, are you going to have a runoff election or you're going to have instant runoffs? An instant runoff system is one in which, let's say, some people vote for Nader. Let's say 48% vote for Bush and 47% vote for Gore, and the rest go to Nader. Now, neither Bush nor Gore in that situation would have 50% of the popular vote. And so an instant runoff system would basically say, okay, all you Nader voters, your man came in third, so he lost. Now, do you have a second choice? Is it Bush? Is it Gore? Or is it none of the above? And in effect, we reallocate your ballots to that second choice immediately, and then someone has a majority of the remaining votes, and that's how a system would work. So if you were to move to direct popular election, you might move to a kind of instant runoff system that would have some implications for third-party candidates.
So if I was voting in that kind of instant runoff system, would I be able to vote my second choice in that one ballot?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. You would say, well, Nader is really the guy I like the most, and then and your vote would be counted for Nader in the first round. But when it became clear that lots of fellow citizens basically disagreed with you, their genuine first choice was either Bush or Gore, you would basically be given now the option. You could express a preference for Bush or Gore, or in effect, you could say, I have no preference between those two. I sit out, in effect, the runoff election. And so we would have on your ballot, we would give you an option of listing a second choice or giving the option to say, of the remaining two, I have no preference.
Chris Gans, what do you think of that?
I think you got a problem, you know, which is only one of a series of problems with direct elections. But I assume that if you wrote the law, that the Bush voters would also have to give a second choice, and the Gore voters would also have to give a second choice, you know, along with the Nader and Buchanan, you know, Hagelin and whoever was running. But suppose, you know, as is the case, a lot of Gore voters find Bush totally anathema. And so instead of, you know, saying no preference, they say Nader, which is indeed, you know, a lot of them would do. And you would be in a situation in which you would not have a majority. And there are, you know, surely people on the right supporting Bush who find Gore anathema. And they may make a second preference of Buchanan.
Yeah, but that doesn't. But that none of that is relevant if the two top vote getters, regardless of whether they have an initial majority, are Bush and Gore. You never get to their second choices. The only people whose second choices count, or third for that matter, are those who are voting for the fringe candidates. That's just
you're just
with all due respect, I think you're not following the system.
Well, you know, all I'm trying to say is, you know, that. It will be hard to design a system that, you know, that is fully acceptable, you know, to the public of the United States if not, you know, if only certain candidates put forward their second choice.
It seems to me you're not going to both agree on this issue today, so let's get to another subject that you're not going to agree on today, which is the future of the Electoral College. Curtis Gans, you support the continuation of the Electoral College. Akhil Amar, you think we should just have a popular vote for the presidency. Curtis Gans, why do you support the continuation of the Electoral College, knowing full well that even in this election, the popular vote might not be the same as the electoral vote?
Well, I support it, and it should be said also with potential modifications, in preference to direct elections. And I support it, you know, because I think historically we wanted the Electoral College because it was an expression of our federalism and our pluralism, and that it forced competition for, you know, both interests and states and regions and grassroots campaigning. I think that's still valid, which is to say, if we move to a direct popular election, essentially in this climate, in this politics, what we would be moving to is a national media campaign. There would be no incentive to go to any particular state and do any particular grassroots organizing. You know, what you would have is a TV and tarmac campaign.
Why does that follow?
Because that's, you know, where we have moved, you know, in the various statewide elections, you know, that Akhil talks about. For instance, the average senatorial budget in a competitive campaign right now spends 60% on media, 30% on fundraising, 10% on candidate travel and staff, and nothing for grassroots activity. That's where that's what our politics has become, and that's what it will become in presidential campaigns. The second and more minor reason is that, by and large, our presidential campaigns get decided on a national level in terms of the popular vote by millions of votes. Increasingly, people do not find their vote makes any difference. But in state contests, those get decided by thousands of votes, and in a few cases, hundreds of votes, and people can see their vote makes a difference. So that I think the incentive provided by the grassroots, by pushing campaigns to the grassroots, pushing campaigns into states, taking into account interests that will be part of a governing coalition, is more important for a governing president than the one-man, one-vote principle. But I do think we can do better, and we can discuss that after Akhil has his say on direct elections.
Well, not so quick. First, we have to take a break. Then we'll talk more about the Electoral College with Akhil Amar and Curtis Ganz. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the Electoral College system. Akhil Amar thinks we should abolish it. He teaches constitutional law at Yale Law School. Curtis Ganz thinks we should keep the system but reform it. Ganz directs the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. Akhil Amar, tell us why you would like to do away with the Electoral College and keep the presidency based on a popular vote.
A few reasons. First, the Electoral College system in its origins is tainted. It's in important respects a product of racism and sexism. Racism first. The basic advantage for many people 200 years ago of an electoral college system instead of direct national election was that it gave the South, the slaveholding South, a leg up. If you had direct national election, there would be many more northern voters than southern voters, but the Electoral College enabled the southern states to count their entire populations, including their slaves. Now, their slaves were discounted, but basically it made states like Virginia the California of the founding, because even though Virginia didn't let very many people vote, it got a lot of electoral votes in the system because it could count its slaveholding population as part of its Electoral College base. Of the first 36 years of the presidency, a slaveholding Virginian is president for the first for 32 of those first 36 years. Washington for 8 years, Jefferson for eight, Madison for eight, Monroe for eight. That's the racism part of it. It's connected to a system that really propped up slavery. The sexism part is also easy to see. If you had direct national election and you enfranchised your women, for example, then your state would actually get a lot more clout in the overall system. So direct national election was actually more democratic 200 years ago, and it would have given incentives to expand the franchise. And so the system that we have inherited is actually a residue of certain things that we don't believe in anymore, like racism and sexism. Now, if it's going to be defended today, there are some possible arguments, but I don't buy them. One argument is somehow that it encourages candidates to go to all sorts of different regions, but so would direct national election, because that's where the votes are. We don't pick our governors by an electoral college system within the state, and the suggestion is, well, then we get these tarmac campaigns. That's what we have for the national presidency too, whether we like it or not, whether we have direct national election or the Electoral College. We're pretty much going to see the same basic national media campaigns, and the reason we are is that in general, the person who wins the electoral vote also wins the popular vote, and vice versa. So you won't see dramatic changes, I think, in the style of campaigning, because in general, what it takes to win one also wins you the other.
Curtis Ganz, I'd like you to respond to Akhil Amar's comments that the Electoral College is based on racism and sexism, and it would, make sense to take that out of the system now by reforming the Electoral College, by getting rid of it.
Two things. I don't think, that the Electoral College historically came out of either of those motivations. The Electoral College came out of the fact, as my colleague Gary Wills has written eloquently, that the Founding Fathers wanted Congress to be the prime entity in government, the legislative body, and that's why, for instance, House members are directly elected. They wanted the president to be basically an administrative officer. They wanted to create a balance between a national government and a federal government, devolving powers to the states. They wanted to create a balance between the big states and the small states, which is why the electors are essentially chosen by a hybrid, which represents both the senators, which are states equal regardless of population, and the representatives, which are states represented by their population. I mean, it was a complex set of factors, and they also didn't particularly want, at that time, the president to have a popular mandate because they saw Congress as being preeminent. I don't know whether any of that's relevant to the current discussion. The fact is that when you look at statewide contests that are now being conducted, they are being conducted by television, and those campaigns, by and large, have very little grassroots activity and have, in those states that rely on television most, like California and New York and others, have had amongst the largest declines in voter participation. It is indeed true that because of the present makeup of the Electoral College system, states are abandoned. But in the states that in which there are battlegrounds and fighting, you don't have only a television and tarmac campaigns. There's about $250 million of party money, to say nothing of interest group money. And by interest group, I mean things like the NAACP as well as the National Association of Manufacturers, which is being poured into grassroots activity to the type of thing that you do not have in statewide campaigns. What we will lose if we move to direct election is the involvement of people in our campaigns.
Curtis Gans, what you're calling, grassroots campaigning, can't you make the argument that that's just more lobbying and more stuff that's as phony as the stuff that you see on television?
I don't think it's phony for people to go to for the NAACP or Rainbow Push or Operation Big Vote to go door to door in the black community and recruit voters. I don't think it's phony for the Christian Coalition to mobilize its membership, or for the environmentalists to express their concern, or both people on each side of the abortion issue. I don't think that's phony at all. I think those people can see how their ground troops, particularly as we move to a lower turnout election, can really make a difference in outcomes. And they only can see that in the context of smaller units. And indeed, the type of reform I would prefer is a reform that would bring it down to smaller units, and would not bring it down to the would not open it up to a large national free-for-all that would be a media campaign.
I basically agree that there's a difference between grassroots campaigning and a television and a tarmac campaign. I simply disagree that direct national election would actually have less grassroots mobilization. I, in fact, think it would have more. So that's just a disagreement as a matter of fact. And I think one other thing. I agree that we want to get more people out. We want to invigorate people in the world's greatest democracy. One way to do that is to give state and local governments a strong incentive to encourage people to vote. The Electoral College has exactly the wrong incentives. A given state gets the same number of electoral votes in the current system, whether a lot of people turn out or very few people turn out. In a direct national election system, each state government would have a very strong incentive to get its citizenry out to make it easy for them to vote, because the more of them voted from that state, the bigger a role they would be playing in the national process. So direct national election would create encouragements for the kinds of legal reforms that would get people out to vote, which and Curtis Gans and I both agree that that's an important thing.
Akilah Marr teaches constitutional law at Yale Law School. Curtis Gans is the director of the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our discussion about the Electoral College system. My guest Akilah Marr says that we should abolish the system. Marr teaches constitutional law at Yale Law School. Curtis Gans directs the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. He says we should keep the system, but reform it. Curtis Gans, if you could reform the Electoral College, which is what you'd really like to do, how would you change it?
From my point of view, the most healthy reform that we could create is that every state should have the system that now exists in Nebraska and Maine. In Nebraska and Maine, if you win the popular vote in that state, you win the two electors that represent the two U.S. senators. But to get any or all of the other electors, you have to compete on a congressional district basis. Now, what that would mean on one level is that if we competed on a congressional district basis, the Electoral College vote would more nearly reflect the popular vote. The more important thing is that it would not make candidates abandon states or regions. Al Gore, with the exception of Tennessee and Arkansas and Florida, has essentially abandoned the South, with good reason. Most of the Southern states are going to go Republican. On the other hand, one-third of the congressional delegation, and a little more, is Democratic. And that would provide an incentive in going congressional district by congressional district for Al Gore to compete in all those southern states for those districts that are Democratic and for those districts that are up for grabs. Similarly, George Bush has virtually abandoned New York, New Jersey, the Northeast, but there are a whole slew of districts there that are either competitive or Republican. What this would do is precisely the opposite of direct elections. It would force candidates to spend more time in all states, and go after grassroots vote and organize the grassroots vote. Because whether Akil likes it or not, when you move to the larger units, the history is clear. We move to television campaigning and we abandon grassroots campaigning, and this revision of the system would move us much more to grassroots campaigning and political organization.
Akilah Marr, what do you think? If we kept the Electoral College, would these reforms be an improvement?
It's a very interesting suggestion. Now, of course, to move to district rather than statewide electoral tallies, as a practical matter, we would need a constitutional amendment because states are not likely to do this on their own for the following reason. If California basically says we're going to allocate our electoral votes by district, then rather than 54, count them, 54 big votes being in play, as a practical matter, maybe only 10 votes would be in play because one candidate would get maybe 35 and the other candidate maybe 20 or something like that. And so now California becomes not that much bigger than, say, New Jersey, if New Jersey retains winner take all. So as a practical matter, each state, with the exception of Nebraska and Maine, has opted for winner-take-all, and that's been true for most of American history, and there are reasons why a state would want to do that to maximize its clout and influence. So if we're going to move on the district model as a practical matter, we would need a constitutional amendment because states are not going to do this individually. There's a collective action problem. Now, if we were to amend the Constitution that way, and as I said, it's an interesting proposal, what we are doing is we're endowing now the district line lines with awesome significance. A lot of these districts are gerrymandered. They're gerrymandered in order to protect congressional incumbents. So whether these are actually the most sensible lines is a question. Some of them are designed to be very safe districts for incumbents. And so once again, actually district by district, there may not be as much contestation as Curtis would like.
Well, you both disagree on what we should do about the Electoral College. Let me bring up an issue that I suspect you agree on, which is that it's sad and depressing that there is such a comparatively low voter turnout. And Curtis Ganz, you say that there's been a pattern of declining voter turnout over the years. I'd be interested in hearing both of your opinions about why this is the case. Curtis Ganz?
Well, we've had a 25% decline in voter turnout nationally since the 1960s in both midterm and presidential elections, 30% outside the South. We've got 25 million people within our midst who used to vote who no longer do so. The United States stands 139th out of 163 democracies in the world. In last 2 years ago's midterm, first-time voters 18 to 19 voted at an 8% rate. We have serious problems for the underpinnings of an American democracy. And most of that's been caused by large issues. I mean, we've had the erosion of trust that started with statements like, I am not going to send American boys to do what Asian boys are supposed to do, and continuing through, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. We've had declines in education, civic education, newspaper reading. We've had our political parties become weaker and more misaligned. We've had, as you saw in this election, network television abdicating its role for the full coverage of politics and public affairs. And we've had the way we conduct our campaigns in 30-second attack ads, which create a miasma over the political system and encourage people not to vote.
Akhil Amar, your thoughts about why voter turnout is so low?
I think Curtis spoke extremely eloquently, and I agree with virtually everything he said. I think that the observation about young adults not voting in large numbers is extremely acute and troubling. The work of Professor Putnam up at Harvard and others have really focused on that and many other declining indices of participation. To go back to the hobby horse of the Electoral College, just one second, I actually think in this election, because elderly Americans turn out to be swing voters in certain swing states, the candidates have focused disproportionate attention on their concerns and perhaps have left out of the conversation young adults who need to be brought into the thing. But let me say one other thing, that just a brighter note. One reason that you might get some kinds of low turnout is because both candidates are relatively reasonable people in the middle. Because of improvements in polling and all the rest, some of the politicians have been able to move toward the middle. And many citizens say, well, it's not that big a difference between them. I could live with both. You get very high turnouts when you have one really extreme candidate on the ballot, a David Duke in Louisiana, for example. And so the slightly less grim story is that we're getting people who we will be able to live with, all of us will be able to live with, perhaps, or at least that might be one story that's a little bit less depressing.
One last question. What do you suspect you're going to find most invigorating and most depressing about the actual media coverage of the election after the polls close?
I want, very simply, the most depressing thing continues to be the networks telling people how they voted while they're still voting. In individual states like Indiana, where they'll project at 6 o'clock and Gary will still be voting, where they'll project in New Hampshire at 7 o'clock and Manchester will be still voting, and where they may project a national winner as early as 9 or 10, although it's unlikely in this close election, and that would depress turnout on the West Coast and perhaps interfere with the results of the election and perhaps the control of Congress. That practice has got to be stopped.
Akhil Amar?
I want to go back to something that Curtis said earlier, with which I agree completely, that the media has defaulted its fundamental responsibility to help American citizens understand what's at stake. We've had an election in which most of the communication has been paid media, sound bites, short ads, often very negative, oversimplifying. The media has not done as good a job at giving candidates free time to expand at length upon their proposals. Even the debate format is one in which it's short sound bites rather than an extended conversation about, let's say, the 8 or 10 most important issues. If it's an important issue in the new millennium, it deserves more than 30 seconds. And yet, even the debate format, and there weren't nearly as many debates as there could have been and should have been, the debate format was 2 minutes on this, then 2 minutes on that, and then on to the other thing, as opposed to a general kind of Lincoln Douglas-like conversation for grown-ups about the issues with more back and forth.
Well, I thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having
thank
us.
You.
Akil Amar teaches constitutional law at Yale Law School. Curtis Gans is the director of the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. Coming up, why early voting and mail-in balloting are at an all-time high. This is Fresh Air.